It is now the midnight hour here in the West. The dark of night, and it's times like these when those mystery animal mutilators are out there on the prowl doing their thing. There are a number of different theories about what's behind it, several prominent theories and explanations. It's aliens and UFOs. It's the government. It's private industry. It's cultists. It's predators. Each of these theories sort of explain some of the cases. None of the theories fit all of the cases. When we come back, Chris O'Brien, my guest, author of the new book, Stalking the Herd, will be joined by his colleague, David Perkins. We'll go through some of the cases, talk about some of the theories that try to explain them away, and then get into the waves of mutilations that spread across American fields and plains starting in the 1970s. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. My guest, Chris O'Brien, and I are now joined by David Perkins, who has been at this UFO and cattle mutilation investigation stuff even longer than Chris and I have. David, welcome to the program. Welcome back to the program, I should say.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. And it's a great show tonight, guys. Yeah, good one.
Tell us a little bit about how you got hooked on these topics. I mean, did you go into the mutilation stuff back in the late 70s thinking UFOs were related?
Good question, yes. Well, I had an interest in UFOs since I was a child, basically. I was reading Carl Jung, Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Skies when I was a teenager. So I'd always had some sort of interest through science fiction, of course. And my father had been in the Air Force, so I picked up a lot of he was at Wright-Patterson at one point. So I picked up some stories from that, fueled a young man's imagination, of course. But I kind of let it simmer for a long time, went to college and moved to Colorado and built a house up on 9,000 feet up on a mountain. And pursued a life of the arts, I guess you'd call it, composing, songwriting, and writing for local publications about Western history and environmental issues. But what really got me going, I suppose, I had this fantasy from when I left college. That was, in the era of Watergate. And I thought, boy, being an investigative journalist would really be the thing. George, you might identify with that.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful position and really romantic and interesting and relevant. And so I thought, well, I'll wait till a good story comes along. That's something that's really worthwhile to pursue. I wish I'd stuck to investigating corruption in local government or something like that. But, of course, like Chris was just talking about, if you're going to take on a mystery, take on a good one, a big one. And when I got into it, I actually fully expected that it was some sort of government testing program, I will say, maybe weapons testing and whatnot. I really thought the trail would lead to the government or something, a large organization, well-financed, maybe for economic reasons, whatever reasons. Second on my list, I suppose, was cultists. And in 75, where I lived in Southern Colorado, it was really hard to miss the mutilation story. It was on the headline of every paper. It was the Associated Press story of the year in Colorado. And I thought, well, something is big here. This is big, whatever this is. And, of course, the UFO reports were sprinkled in that mix. So I started collecting files in 75 from all the newspapers. And there was a mutilation in my neighborhood, actually very close to my house, of which I was briefly the chief suspect. Which I always thought
was a great way to get started. There he is.
Right out of the gate, you're the suspect in the crime. Well, there'd been a mutilation near the road about a mile south of my house, and there were three drops of blood on three rocks leading the direction of my house. And since I'd moved into the area fairly recently, along with a bunch of artist types, read the subtext there.
Yeah, they figured the hippies did it. The hippies down the road did it.
Okay, whatever. Immediately I heard about it, and I thought, well, I'd seen it actually driving home, and I stopped and looked at it and went, this is one of those mutilations. Wow. Looked at it really carefully and went home and thought about it and went, wow. So that next day I said, I'm going to go see the newspaper editor and start seeing what I can gather and then go on to see the sheriff about it. So I went to the editor first, and he said, well, I think you should know, Dave, that the sheriff considers you a prime suspect in the case.
Well, let's fast forward a little bit. You got hooked on the topic. You later worked with Linda Howe a little bit on her magnificent program, A Strange Harvest.
That's true. That's true. I was just jumping. I just want to lay that little bit of background that I had traveled around. I started going to sheriff's offices, and you know, they were very generous with their material. They'd lay out their files for me and let me have it, whatever I wanted, copy anything off. And in those files, I kept seeing these reports of UFO-type craft. These are from Colorado sheriffs. You know, these are not some hippy-dippy New Agers. You know, this is hard-boiled stuff here. So I made a note of that. I thought, well, could this possibly be a UFO-related phenomenon? And the more I looked into it, I thought it was a definite possibility. It was hard to ignore at that point. So that went on through into the late 70s, and I did actually, Linda Howe called me up, and when she was starting to get into it, I piled all my files into my station wagon, drove them up to Denver. She copied everything off, and then we went on a couple of road trips together, interviewing some of the witnesses I'd found in that area.
Okay. I'll tell you what, let me shift gears here for a second. That's David, I'll come back to you, and I wanted you to tell us about this hearing that that Harrison Schmidt, Senator Schmidt, had called. But first, to set the stage, Chris, maybe you could describe sort of how widespread the mutilations became in the 70s, because it just went crazy, and you describe it in the book.
Yeah, it's a real complicated scenario that I really, going in, didn't have a real total, you know, feeler out for exactly the extent of this. But what really struck me, and what David reminded me early on, was a lot of these cases that occurred from 70 through 73 involved rustling of livestock, which I mentioned before, and also it got even hot and heavy where ranches were actually firing on mystery helicopters, and the chopper people aboard the choppers in a few cases actually fired back. So there was a wave of rustling that occurred in Nebraska in 71, and then everything kind of dropped away in 72, and we had an amazing UFO wave, of course, in 73, a huge one. But we also had attendant helicopter activity and cattle rustling. And then slowly, towards the end of 73, you started seeing cases, mutilation cases being reported. And so we're talking about from Minnesota down, you know, the Midwest, down into Texas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Iowa. And then it slowly kind of drifted west and then exploded in 75 all over the West. And it just, at that point, it gets kaleidoscopic, and it gets very difficult to really, you know, unravel all these different cases, waves that are going on simultaneously.
But the ranchers are screaming. They're saying, hey, this is costing us a lot of money. I would imagine some of them, it might have come close to putting them under. These are valuable animals, and some of them are victimized over and over again, right?
Right. Well, for various reasons, 80% of the small ranching operations in business in 75 are out of business today. So, yeah, I think the long-term effects in terms of the social implications in the ranching community are you know, pretty catastrophic. Obviously, economic factors come into play, but we're seeing the death of the small ranching operation in many parts of the West and Midwest, and we're seeing the conglomeration of large cattle concerns. And this gets very, very complicated and nuanced. There's so many different elements that seem to be interwoven throughout these waves, which I outline in a time-based, timeline format. So,
but the characteristics of the individual mutilations, the characteristics of the ones that we know now, I mean, scalpel-like cuts, right? It's not a predator doing this stuff. It's somebody using sharp instrument.
Well, I think, yeah, for many
some
cases, that would be the case. But like I said early on, as soon as the media gets involved, then you see a real upsurge in cases because almost every dead cow out there that has any sort of unusual-looking scavenger action on it is reported as mutilated, which really, as David will attest to, really kind of muddies the water and has you really running around like a chicken without a head trying to make heads or tails of what's going on. Garbage in, garbage out scenario. But that's not to say that all these cases, as the skeptics and debunkers would attest, all these cases were scavenger action. I think the book does a pretty good job of laying out some cases that we still can't explain.
David, why don't you tell us the strangest case that you personally investigated? Does one come to mind?
Oh, geez. Oh, everybody always asks that. I don't know. Depends on your definition of strange, I suppose. But they're all pretty strange, let's put it that way. But
well, let's talk about the characteristics of the animal itself, the nature of the wounds or the nature of what was done to its flesh.
Yeah. Well, the ones I saw, and I suppose that's somewhere in the vicinity of 50, were all relatively similar. There were cord rectums, udders removed, slices of the jaw cut off, the tongue missing, area around the eye carved out, I call it, ear cut off perhaps, sex organs removed. They looked pretty similar, which is interesting in itself, as if there was, there's some kind of program going on here, that there's these parts are needed by someone. And of course, to my mind, and to a lot of people who looked at these things, it appeared to be some sort of testing because obviously the prime meat wasn't being taken. It wasn't for that purpose. The animals were often described as missing blood, which I will attest to as far as I could tell. I think a lot of them are happen under spooky circumstances, and those are the ones I really consider strange. If you're working on a particular theory, for instance, I was working on the nuclear testing theory, that the animals were being tested for radiation in the environment. As soon as I was on in the newspapers in New Mexico saying spokesman links mutilations to nuclear test cycle or something. And then while I was working on that, I get a call to go out to Santa Clara Indian Reservation where there was a cow with its nose and its mouth in a stream that was flowing directly out of Los Alamos. It was just bubbling. The water was bubbling through its mouth, and it was a classic mutilation. So those kind of synchronicities, that kind of stuff is spooky when you feel like the phenomenon is monitoring you or something. So there's some kind of intimate connection.
You were at the truck stop, and when you woke up in the morning, you were on your way north, I think, to Wyoming or someplace. And when you woke up in the morning, there was one right there.
Well, I was on my way to see Linda Howe, as a matter of fact.
Oh, okay.
We were getting ready to go out and film Strange Harvest, and I had some time to kill, so I went out east of Colorado Springs, out to Elbert County, and I was poking around and interviewing people and whatnot, and I stopped at a diner, had something to eat, left my wallet in the diner, which I never leave my wallet anywhere, but get down the road, I realized I left my wallet, so I drive back, the diner's closed. I think, oh, geez. So I said, well, I'm going to camp in the back of my station wagon out over here in this road, in the middle of nowhere, and pull out the sleeping bag, sleep, wake up. There's a mutilated cow out in the field.
Wow.
That apparently wasn't there the night before. I don't know. Maybe it was, but sure seemed awfully fresh. That kind of stuff. And I'm writing an article on the robed figures in mutilation lore, for instance.
Well, tell us that.
Chris has covered this in the book, but just very briefly, there's several cases of these robed figures around mutilation sites, and they do things like form chains across the highway and block traffic in the middle of the night and scare the bejesus out of people and roam around and just are very suspicious and never caught. So I was writing about the robed figures for this article, and then I get a call from the sheriff. There was a mutilation near the interstate, and three robed figures were cruising back and forth by the site the day before. So I'm going like, wow, that's uncanny. Then the robed figures actually came through my neighborhood and stopped at the little general store. I didn't see them, but the owners said they thought they were monks of some sort, and they were there to buy supplies to go fishing in this place called Lily Lake. which is on Mount Blanca, where nobody fishes. They were inconspicuous, non-conspicuous-looking people, and but I mean that to me is strange. See, that's the strange aspect, more than even the animals. Like all these synchronicities that happen around us.
It does feel like tricksters, skinwalker, or men in black, John Keel type stuff.
Yes, Chris. Exactly.
Chris, what do you make of the people in robes? Is that just something somebody threw in to mess with your heads, or what?
No, I don't think that. There's not many reports. If you look at everything in toto, there's not that many reports, but there are key reports. For instance, Keith Wolverton, was a captain in charge of mutilation investigations up in Cascade County, Montana. In fact, I think he was coordinating statewide efforts. And there were a number of reports that Montana authorities had of robe figures, and even one case where there was a ritual site. We had a case in 1980 in Iowa that was very, very well documented. There was even veterinary pathology examinations of some mutilation cases that are just... I mean, they curl your toes. I mean, some of the top veterinary pathologists can't duplicate, or have a hard time duplicating some of the cuts that were done. Totally dismissing any notion that this could have been done by scavengers. And you have attendant, nearby these areas where mutilations are being reported. You have abandoned houses with ritual altars and weird, sigils and sayings on the wall that appear to be satanic in nature. And these types of interesting little tendrils in not only the occult angle, but in other angles, too, you see weaving their way through the totality of this mystery. And it's just when you start to unravel all this stuff and really look at it and go, you look at it in context, in a timeline, you start to see some pretty interesting patterns.
Well, it's as if, at least in some of it, that somebody throws you for a loop. Either they can guess where you're going to go, or they're reading your minds, or not just you, but everybody involved in investigating this stuff. I mean, does it ever seem to you, David, that it's something or someone is trying to stay one step ahead of the people
it
trying to unravel?
It does seem that way, but the conclusion that I eventually had to draw was that somehow, it was what they call an idioplastic phenomenon. In other words, it's conforming to your beliefs, your expectations, your needs, whatever. It conforms to the observer. So this kind of gets into quantum observer effects or something. To what degree do we create these situations? Is it possible? So either that or, somebody is reading your mind and trying to mess with you. And I just find that if you're looking at it from a UFO angle, I was reading a section in the Skinwalker book the other day, and the part where Gwen, I guess we can call her, the Sherman's wife, was having all her silverware. Somebody was hiding her silverware in her kitchen and in the microwave and all the household utensils. And to me, that's the kind of thing, it's like, why would somebody fly or get here from another planet to come and do all this kind of stuff and waste their time hiding our silverware, It's kind of like a John Keel type of scenario. It's like, why?
They're only here to confound us.
Yeah, don't they have anything better to do? I mean, watch grass grow or something? I don't know. I mean, watch people sleep. The idea that they could insinuate themselves into our lives and would want to, I found preposterous.
Well, I've thought the same thing when those who have tried to explain away some of that Skinwalker stuff, well, it's got to be some commando unit. It's some kind of military training exercise. So which commando gets the assignment of sneaking into the bathroom and taking her hairbrush out of the locked door, that kind of stuff?
Right.
We're gonna get into some of these scenarios. I want you guys to tell me which ones you think work and which ones don't as possible explanations. We're talking with Chris O'Brien about his new book, Stalking the Herd, and his colleague David Perkins has joined him. A lot of theories about what might be behind the animal mutilation mystery. None of the theories seems to fit all the cases, though. We're going to go down them one by one and ask the question, why would anyone leave these carcasses behind regardless? Why would the UFO knots do it? Why would the secret government agents do it? Why not just haul these bodies away and carve them up somewhere else? Unless they want us to scare us, or they want to get our attention. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. So this wave of mutilations gets so bad that Senator Harrison Schmidt of New Mexico organizes a get-together for lawmen, investigators, ranchers to try to figure something out. And David Perkins, you were not only there, you were the first guy to get up and speak. From what I read in the book, these guys, everyone had a pretty open mind. They're willing to listen to anyone about any idea because I guess the official report that had been done by this ex-FBI guy blaming it on predators, not many people were believing that, right?
Right. Well, you know, the so-called Rommel report, Operation Animal Mutilation, that came after the Schmidt conference.
Okay.
And Schmidt, it still puzzles me to this day, and I understand you have some tidbits that would help my understanding, which we can't go into at this point, but about Schmidt's reasoning for that, but I never understood it. Because he was a U.S. senator at the time, a moonwalking geologist. From a political point of view, and I was schooled in political science, it was suicide in this state. He lost the next election. He gave this conference. He must have known it would attract all kinds of UFO people and the lawmen both. But it was the papers in New Mexico just blasted him, especially, you know, the conservative ranching community, saying it was a circus, it was a zoo, it was a joke. And Schmidt must be out of his mind to put something like that together. So he took a lot of heat and lost the election. And then as a follow-up to that, then they launched the Rommel report was launched. It had nothing to do with Schmidt. It was a law enforcement administration grant, a federal grant, $50,000 roughly to put that probe together, which I had a breakfast with Rommel just before he took on the job, and he flat out told me that it was he was out to debunk the whole thing and caused a lot of grief for a lot of the people involved, implying Schmidt and people like Gabe Valdez and others who were promoting the extra mundane nature of the mutilations. So it was, mutilations get involved in politics. They get involved in everything. It seems like their fingers go everywhere into every realm of human endeavor. But I did give the keynote speech, and I've never seen such a strange collection of people with the FBI and all the spooky types and the Indian chiefs and the ranchers and the New Agers in robes and all kinds of other people that I couldn't even begin to classify what they were doing there. But it was a circus. It's true.
Wow. Chris, let's go down some of the prevalent possible explanations for this stuff and start with this question. In any of these scenarios, why does anybody leave the carcasses behind, the remains behind, whether it's UFOs or government or private industry or whatever? That's the question you get asked, right? Why don't they just take the whole cow?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the answer is pretty simple. If they leave the animal behind, there's plausible deniability. If they take it, it's larceny. It's theft. A police report gets filed. Investigations ensue. The ranching community literally arms itself and gets kind of a vigilante group mind going. And we did see that in the early 70s, and all of a sudden it seemed like the MO switched, and they left the animals behind. And what you do when you do that is you leave yourself plausible deniability. You can always say, oh, it must have been scavengers, this is mundane, there's nothing to see here, no report gets filed. You know, there are not many ranchers that are going to spend a bunch of money to figure out or ascertain, how an animal died and how it was disfigured. They're not going to spend money on a lost investment. So it's kind of fiendishly self-nullifying if you leave the animal behind. If you take it, it's a crime. So it's one of those nuances that a lot of people, they think, well, the government, they can just buy their own cows and, or rent them or whatever and have their own cows and do their own thing. And they do that. We have, and I mentioned in the book, a case of an EPA scientist who was monitoring a sheep herd on rented pasture in the San Luis Valley. And he was down the Alamosa River from a Superfund site, and he was monitoring the levels of heavy metals in the in the sheep that were grazing there. And when he found out that the levels were, that the animals should have been dead and that they were still going into the food chain, you know, other ranches around there, he wanted to warn the ranching community there. And he was told by the EPA, no, you can't. And in protest, he became a whistleblower, went to the press, and spilled the beans. Now, this could be just tip of the iceberg. We don't know to what extent the government is renting pasture, buying animals, doing secret, experiments on animals to ascertain environmental factors or whatever they're looking for. So I think that just further complicates things, if they leave them behind.
Doesn't it also frighten people? Does it suggest, we can do this with impunity, and it's pretty spooky, as suggesting
right.
Maybe you humans could be on the menu too?
Well, and also you can be a rich rancher trying to buy out ranches around you and spend money possibly to hire teams to go out and do it as an intimidation tactic. And there's some evidence to suggest that has taken place, which I cover in the book as well. In fact, I have law enforcement that come right out publicly and state, you know, this particular rancher on this ranch was aiding and abetting helicopter crews that were responsible for mutilating dozens and dozens of animals in Costilla County and Conejos County in the San Luis Valley. So it just, you're seeing multiple layers, one on top of the other, and possibly at the bottom of that whole pile is whatever has been predating cattle and disfiguring them down through history, 1606 and in and around London, as we described earlier. So it appears that there's multiple agendas at work. I think David, when he came up with the environmental monitoring theory in late 78, in 79, that most of these waves of mutilation cases appear to be taking place downwind and downstream of where we utilize uranium, where we mine it, where we enrich it, where we weaponize it, where we put it into missiles, where we use it as fuel for power plants, where we explode, 100 above ground nuclear detonations. If you look at the maps of the spread of that radiation across, across the Rockies and then up into Canada, these are the hardest hit places really in this whole phenomenon. So I think David's theory of environmental monitoring is an important one, and that's the one to me that makes the most sense. Then you have this whole occult angle. There seems to be a veneer of ritual blood sacrifice going on. I'm almost standalone in this. David disagrees with me about much of my theorizing that this mutilation phenomenon could possibly be tied into our humankind's ancient practice of animal sacrifice. And I've been exploring that particular angle. David has really taken me to school, and the two of us have researched how all these theories really first began, who were the ones that were promulgating these theories, how they got legs, how they became, successful memes within the culture, and then how those memes attracted other memes to them to create a constellation of memes, or a super meme, for lack of a better term. And, it gets so complicated, and all these agendas may be operative, including a potential, ET-type agenda as well that may tie into the ancient cases.
Well, let's talk about that one, for example, because that's the one that got my attention when I first started looking at it. It's what Linda Howe has concentrated on for most of her career. It's because you hear these compelling reports. Witnesses say, we saw UFOs, they're flying around, we saw lights in the sky. And then you have occasional reports like Judy Doherty, who says, not only did I see a cow being mutilated, but I was abducted. I mean, those are compelling statements. And there are at least some compelling cases that suggest something like a UFO or alien or something is involved with this.
And right. for every UFO report you have, you have a dozen or more dozens of mystery helicopter sightings. So, are the helicopters actually UFOs being cloaked, and they're actually real UFOs that look like helicopters? And, I'm not sure about that. I really have a sense that you can't go down, you can't put blinders on and look at any one particular theory and exclude all the other data. It's really important, I think, to be as objective and open-minded about this and be intellectually honest and look at all the data. You can't just cherry-pick you know, the UFO cases that you described, Judy Doherty, the Missouri case where they saw the beams, you know, they have the cow suspended between these beams. These are very, very rare. I mean, compared to the number of helicopter reports, I mean, there's just a handful. You just have to look at this from an open-minded perspective, and you can't factor anything in or out at this point.
If you have, David, say...
What do you think about that, David?
Which part?
Well, about factoring any particular theory in and any particular theory out. For every theory you come up with, George, you can have, you have way more data that you could possibly need to refute it. So everything is nullifying everything else.
David, where are you on the UFO alien type theory, and how is that still on your list?
It has to be. It has to be. I mean, Chris and I discuss it in terms of provisional theories. And what we'd like to think we do is maintain, you know, several provisional theories at once in our minds as we move along and see where the data fits, you know, as it comes in. Does it fit into this, fit over there? And that seems like an ability that's really a must in this business, to be able to do that, simultaneously maintain provisional theories. And you've got to have the ET theory. It's got to be in there, and it's right toward the top in my book. But as I've said, I mean, it's the same. If you say ETs did this, it's about the same as saying God did it. Because if you're assuming that ETs could be, you know, millions of years more advanced than humans, then they would be able to do anything technologically to make us think or see or do anything that they want us to do, theoretically. I mean, what's the Arthur C. Clarke quote about any superior culture, their technology will appear as magic to the inferior culture, that kind of idea. So if you say ETs did it, that's hard to refute, because they could theoretically do anything. But that intellectually, to me, it doesn't exactly work, you know. But it's just because of my own personal experiences in dealing with this thing, it just seems like it's somehow too form-fitting to the culture that it's arising out of and to the individuals involved with it. And it just seems to go back more toward human consciousness.
Well, let's say you had something like UFOs involved in some cases, some small percentage of the cases, UFOs, aliens, weird lights, flying saucers, and the public generally knows that takes place, and it's written off. It largely because it's just too weird. And you have another group of mutilators who operate under the umbrella of that. Mm-hmm. We can get away with mutilating all the cows we want because people will just blame it on UFOs.
Right.
And we can mutilate with impunity.
Yeah, it self-nullifies itself. It's ingenious the way these potential provisional theory agendas appear to be overlapping one on top of the other. And, you know, we even have red herring cases that try to... I've seen this a number of times where we have cases that appear to be high strange that are really peculiar, and then all of a sudden you have cases that are removed from that case in the same region but on the periphery of the region, trying to get you to focus your attention elsewhere. Those cases don't appear to be as pristine and high strange as the initial cases that you know, are obviously worthy of further investigation. So it's almost like there's a red herring game going on as well, as agendas being overlapped on one another.
And you also got some weird ones where somebody's trying to make you think one way because some of the physical evidence that's left behind. My friends at NIDS, National Institute for Discovery Science, and you mentioned them in the book, they had found some strange chemical compounds that were left behind. And then you have a case where somebody left a gas mask behind, and other physical evidence, wherein in all these other hundreds and thousands of cases, no blood, no tracks, and all of a sudden, oops, somebody left behind a couple of artifacts.
Well, I want to know when one of these sheriff's departments is going to actually be able to bring down one of these mystery helicopters. We have a number of cases where, you know, as I mentioned earlier, gunfire was exchanged. In one case, the rancher was actually fired upon by a group on the ground as well as a group in the helicopter. And we have some Costilla County cases in 75 where they almost, in their estimation, brought a helicopter down. It was smoking them, and they said it must have had a hard time getting back to wherever it came from, which they thought was Fort Carson, but that was just their guess. So, you know, if helicopters are actually UFOs masquerading as helicopters, man, I'll tell you, a bunch of sheriff deputies with 30-06s and, you know, can almost bring one down. Their technology isn't that far advanced for us.
Predators do kill sheep and cattle. They do eat them here and there. David, obviously that does not explain all the cases. Give me your thoughts. We're going to go to a break here in about 3 minutes, but give me your thoughts about predator cases. And then it sounds like you have a disagreement with Chris about satanic cults.
Oh, not really, but it's just where you want to put your emphasis or where your interest leads your intuition, I suppose. In terms of predators, you know, even that is a provisional theory with me, as much as I hate to admit it. But, you know, I have to accept the fact that, okay, this could be the biggest mass delusion in the history of humanity. Just an incredible coincidence that all these things happen this way. But nonetheless, it was misidentification of natural predation. It's possible, and the thing I find odd right now is if we went down that road, it seems like sociologists would have a field day with this material. This would be the biggest mass delusion ever. And the theories that they, you know, case studies that they trot out to back up this kind of thing is like the windshield pitting in Seattle, whenever that was. When was it, Chris? 50s, 60s, I can't remember. The gist of it was one day everybody in Seattle woke up and their windshields were pitted, and they thought it was some supernatural something or other had happened. And then the conclusion of the study was, well, on that day everybody just looked at their windshield instead of through their windshield, and they were all deluded. And then it created some sort of mass hysteria where everybody thought their windshields were pitted. So, you know, that's the level that they're working on, the mass delusion. But it seems like a good sociologist could get a hold of this material and say, boy, this takes the cake for mass delusions.
Yeah, but what happens when cases end and you don't have any reports for months, even years? I mean, everybody wakes up and is not delusional one day?
We went over that with George in 1972. We were both so puzzled why there are no cases in 72, relatively nothing. And before that, the whole build-up, the Rommel report and everything else had been, well, these ranchers are deluded, and the sheriffs are deluded, and the public's deluded. Everybody's crazy. But, you know, then suddenly, January 1st, 1972, everybody wakes up, and they're not deluded anymore. There are no cases, no reports, no nothing. This is the kind of anomaly that really, you know, sticks out.
I guess the predators weren't hungry that year.
Exactly.
Well, as we said, it's there's no theory that fits all the cases. Each of those theories fits some of the cases, but we have explored, Chris, you and I have had a chance to talk about it before, about a fairly exotic possible explanation, the involvement of an environmental, sort of a version of the environmental monitoring theory involving mad cow. And the implications of mad cow or some other kind of contamination in the food chain are massive. I don't think we have time before the break to get into that, but we're going to jump into that when we come back, and then we're going to open up the phone lines. And David, are you going to stick around with us?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. We're talking with Chris O'Brien and David Perkins about the new book, Stalking the Herd. We'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions and comments in just a little bit. Stay with us, everyone. Much more Coast to Coast AM to come.